Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, it's part two of our partnership with the Spokesman Review's Summer Stories Project. Each year, the newspaper publishes a series of short stories, all dealing with a particular theme. This year's theme was Summer of 69. Tonight, we'll hear Stephanie Oakes read her story, Oracle, followed by Megan Rowe reading her story, Tranquility Base. So let's travel back 50 years to that historic summer. Here's author Stephanie Oakes.
Oracle. Hannah could see the future in car parts, in the slick backs of brake pads, in the calcified pathways charted by battery acid, in the shattered bodies of taillights, metal and filaments and needles of glass spread like entrails on the oiled garage floor. She'd crouch in her khaki jumpsuit and study the spilled contents of some customer's Camaro and be struck, sudden and bright, by a vision of the future. Teresa, the shop's receptionist, would find Hannah like that, repositioning her head like a TV antenna, neck cocked uncomfortably, searching for the clearest signal, the most accurate view of this flash of future. "This winter will be the worst anyone has ever seen," she said, eyes still fixed on the garage floor. "Okay," Teresa said, drawing out the word. "The parts you ordered are in." Teresa was Hannah's only friend, the only other woman Hannah saw most days. Though Teresa huffed in exasperation at Hannah's strange ways, her odd eyes plucking images of the future from the air, her oil-veined hands, her shirking of every trapping of womanhood, Teresa tolerated Hannah in a way that most people did not. On breaks, Teresa would tell Hannah about her children, about her plans to become a nurse practitioner, about the people in her night classes. "A guy named Milton asked me out. On one hand, I really like him. On the other hand, his name is Milton." And Hannah would tell Teresa about her visions. "That guy Milton, he's getting arrested for shoplifting next week." When that winter of 1969 arrived, it was no surprise to either of them when snow fell for months without abating. "You called it," Teresa said one morning when, from the open garage doors, they watched cars fumble over themselves all the way down Division. Across town, snow pushed its hands over the rooftops as though to suffocate everyone beneath, and some did die inside, in the toxin-filled cabin of a car, in tunneled snowbanks that swallowed children whole, in the sudden accordion of a parking garage closing furiously. Hannah lived alone in the woods north of town, in a cabin where, all winter, the roof groaned like a sick animal. Hannah hardly saw anyone in her woods. Those she did were covered in pelts and leather fringe, smelling sweetly of marijuana. Bigfoot hunters, survivalists, living off the land, the straps of army-issued duffel bags stretched between shoulder blades, the memory of blood and bullet sounds simmering inside of them. Men shy of Hannah's eyes, who flinched away when she caught glimpses. Into her head, an image. The man, whose body held memories of unimaginable destruction, whose very muscles wound around the memories like bird nests, would, in 40 years, live inside the salt-stuffed air where a river meets the sea. He would fish from a boat, tend tomatoes, speak to a therapist every week on a small flat screen that Hannah did not understand. Hannah breathed out, relief loosening her chest. The visions didn't always go that way. All her life, Hannah had been good at predicting things. She would shout, "Sneeze!" just before her mother's body was racked by one. She was skilled at getting kids at school in trouble for crimes they had not yet committed. When she saw a vision of her childhood cat jumping into a trash can, she made her parents drive 10 miles away to the local landfill where they found him, slightly battered and covered in coffee grounds, but alive. Hannah's family never did figure her out. They were beautiful in a way that seemed definitive, that seemed to reject all other kinds of family. Dressed in matching gingham and holiday photos, father with his slick car and hard drink, mother in her rigid smile and stiff dresses, who told Hannah exactly what the Bible said about soothsayers and women who dress like men. Hannah got very good at hiding herself from them, hid her premonitions, hid her body behind dresses that violated something deep within her, hid the cheerleader she kissed inside the equipment shed, washed in the smell of leather and grass and sweat. And when, in a vision, she saw the cheerleader's wedding just after graduation, she hid that too, the sorrow that she found surprisingly easy to swallow. The day after Hannah left school, she opened her mother's sewing kit, pushed aside spirals of yellow measuring tape and a tomato-shaped cushion dotted with pearlescent pins until she found scissors. Carefully, resolutely, she placed the cool blades to her scalp and cut until only a fingernail's length of hair remained. Finished, she stared down at the pile of chestnut ribbons that had recently been attached to her, feeling like something had come away, not from her head, but from her chest, from her lungs, ribs, from the tiny, slick, crimson cranny where she imagined her soul resided. She traveled downtown to the Bon Marché and bought a pair of canvas slacks and a flannel shirt, never wore a dress again, and she found a job at a mechanic shop. Years later, she had a good life, a solid life. She had placed the bricks of it herself and now, surveying, was pleased with what she'd built. And if her visions made it hard to keep friends or partners, she was grateful for them. They had kept her safe. At the shop, as snowplows slashed pathways through the mountainous snow, Hannah bent over the clicking golden engine of an Oldsmobile. When her vision grew bright, she straightened, waiting for the future to slide fully across her eyes. Hannah saw herself, her own body, not much older than she was now. Her button shirt had rounded out, her broad legs slightly bowed, as though hefting a great weight, and inside her, Hannah could sense the red throb of an infant sitting just between the fan blades of her pelvis. A dull feeling ran through her, chilled her. Though she had never been wrong, Hannah knew this vision could not be true. She'd always believed having a baby to be impossible. A sense she had that her body, with all its edges, would be inhospitable. Even the word mother, too soft, too aproned and done up and ready with dinner. The year before, she'd attended her sister's baby shower. The frothy confection of her sister, the elegant globe of her belly, tenderly pink, trimmed in lace, haloed by her sister's delicate fingers, cemented the certainty in Hannah's mind that motherhood could never be hers. When her niece was born, Hannah declined to hold her. Too fumbling, too calloused, too grease-covered, the opposite of maternal. Hannah shook the vision from her mind, the image sliding away like a photo slide across a projector. It was a mistake, she thought. She was bound to be wrong sometime. But the vision returned the next day while changing a battery, and the next day while sweeping metal filings curved like silver fingernail clippings from the shop floor. You'll never guess what I saw. Hannah crouched beside Teresa's desk on her break. Pregnant? Teresa asked, eyes trailing across Hannah in her jumpsuit. The idea of her pregnant, Hannah knew, was ridiculous. I've never been wrong before. Who says you're wrong? Teresa asked. Hannah could only stare. You could do it, you know, Teresa said. Doesn't seem so far-fetched to me. I could never, Hannah sputtered. Not with a man. Teresa shook her head. Who said anything about a man? Even before the first sperm bank in Washington, there were other ways, older ways, Teresa explained, for a woman who had no interest in men to become pregnant. Women in Spokane had long whispered about a woman you could go to with the kind of problems that couldn't be solved elsewhere. Some called her a witch, and others called her a low-cost medical alternative, who cured crabs and bad ovaries, who planted seeds inside the uteruses of women like Hannah, and removed such seeds from those of others. But my visions, Hannah said. When she'd allowed herself to picture a child, she also saw, stepping stoned in front of her, all the pain the girl would know. Pain Hannah would see coming. Her daughter, crashing her bike, gazing from the red oblong of unshuttered flesh on her knee, studded with gravel, to where Hannah stood. Did you predict that? She'd ask. And when Hannah'd say, yes, a sob the girl had clenched inside her chest would unloose itself. Every paper cut, every dog nip, every failed test, every wrong joke, through all the humiliations of girlhood, with its blood, with its bite, with its lack of mercy, her daughter would harbor just a speck of resentment, because Hannah could save her from all of it. That's called being a mother, said Teresa. You could save them from pain, but somehow it wouldn't make them hurt less. And so, slightly dazed, Hannah found herself traversing the snow-covered miles to a cottage near the National Forest, prepared to place $300 bills inside the hand of a woman named Rosemary, who wore a patched corduroy dress and a smile that split her face like rays of the sun. It's really not that out there, Rosemary said, explaining the theory behind artificial insemination. Farmers have done it forever with cows. My mother would say it's an abomination, Hannah said, eyes roving around the cottage, full of macrame and dried lavender and sickly-looking potions and brown glass bottles. A rejection of good morals. Your mother sounds like a peach, Rosemary told her, hunched over a small chest freezer. Take your pick. Rosemary held up two frozen shot glasses of the stuff. The options were bleak. That of a 19-year-old who ran the witch's errands, or that of a mountain man who left his hidey hole only often enough to visit the Colville Stop and Shop for Wonder Bread and whiskey. In the end, Hannah said she couldn't decide, because either way, the baby'd be there in the end, and so Rosemary selected for her. It was not painful, but Hannah grimaced through the whole encounter, the frozen plug dissolving slowly, aided by a tablespoon of sugar. Helps them get their sea legs, Rosemary explained, radiating cold throughout her body. Hannah gazed at the witch's ceiling and, in the crosshatch of bare beams, a vision assembled. The same one, of her body, convex. She saw that perhaps she would look ridiculous, in her dungarees and buttoned shirts, hunching over a car engine, while outside, rivulets of snowmelt siphoned into storm drains, rivulets of sweat falling across her abdomen through the summer of 69. But, in her vision, Hannah could see, at last, that there was nothing confusing about her body. It was strong, good. It had been all along.
That was Stephanie Oakes reading her short story, Oracle, originally published in the July 14th issue of the Spokesman Review. After she read her story, Stephanie and I sat down to talk about the inspiration behind it. So the prompt for this year's summer stories was the summer of 69. So when you got that prompt, what made you decide to write this story about Hannah?
This one was probably the most difficult of all of the summer story prompts for me. This is my fourth one. And the specificity of a particular year was a little more challenging, particularly because everything that I knew about that happened in that year was so large and significant. And that, for me, is a more difficult thing to write about than something more simple. I ended up Googling what happened in Spokane in 1969, and I found that we had a pretty terrible snowstorm that a lot of people still remember. From the winter of 68 and 69, it was like broke tons of records, people died, parking garage collapsed, and kids died in sledding accidents and in like breathing in fumes from their car while they were parked in in the snow. So so that was the initial spark of the idea, and then it took a lot of like false starts. I have a document full of like 10 or 15 story starts that just didn't go anywhere, and then eventually I kind of had this vision of this woman in her jumpsuit working at a mechanic shop and seeing the future. So sort of the two kind of met. And that's how the story came.
The other historical thing that's mentioned in the story is like the arrival of sperm banks. Was that a Googled thing too? Was that sort of a topical thing that happened around that era?
Yeah, I knew that I wanted her. I wrote it. It just sort of came out that she would see herself being pregnant, and that that would be for someone who has at the time. There aren't a lot of options for gay people becoming parents, and maybe that's something that a person in that position would find impossible. There were sperm banks in the U.S. at the time, which I learned by researching, but not at all common. So I was pretty fascinated about that, and I read quite a bit about how sperm banks came to be as common as they are now. Mm. And that if there wasn't one in your community, what would you be left with? What would your option be? And there probably would be someone you could go to, or, you know, someone that would know how to make it happen.
Yeah. A witch.
Yeah. A witch. There's always got to be a witch, you know.
I've been talking with Stephanie Oakes, the author of Oracle, the short story published in the Spokesman Review as part of their Summer Stories project. And this year's Summer Stories prompt was the summer of 1969. Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Next, we'll hear author Megan Rowe read her short story, Tranquility Base, which takes this year's Summer Stories theme in a completely different direction.
Tranquility Base. Leading up to the launch, Janet Armstrong told Life magazine, "I'm not married to an astronaut. I'm married to Neil Armstrong. I knew he wanted to go to the moon somehow, some way, when I married him." With children living and dead, Jan observed Apollo 11's flight from a yacht moored on the Banana River. Her boys used binoculars, but she knew there was nothing to see by looking closer. She wondered if he hid a letter for the children. It would be in the false bottom of his desk drawer. She knew more than he thought. As a child, Sarah counted between lightning and thunder to calculate a storm's proximity. As an adult, she reads the Chicago Tribune, cradling a mug in the breakfast nook decorated with hand-stenciled strawberries. Her mother raps on the door, balancing a box under her arm. "Can't stay," her mother says, placing it on the table. "No room in the new place." Sarah's parents split 2 months ago after decades of marriage. President Bill Clinton said, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman," and invaded the complicity of thousands of living rooms. In her parents' case, Bill left Hillary for Monica. Her mother's mantra, good riddance. Apollo came down gently, more like the craft was reaching for the moon than landing. "Eagle is at tranquility, over." With 600 million people tuning in, Walter Cronkite said, "There's a foot coming down the steps." Armstrong's heart rate accelerated to 140 beats per minute. He was making eye contact with an object of love. He tested stability on each rung like he was emerging from an attic. Cocooned by cotton candy insulation and sun-glittering dust, Sarah sets the box next to the wooden rocking horse. No space downstairs, too precious to toss. What else are attics for? Sarah has a good life, but that doesn't stop her from looking for clues of who she is or might have been or still could be. Sentimentality is a trap. Once ignited, nostalgia's sepia romanticism dulls the present. The box begs to be opened. She settles in spread-eagled, searching for her undoing. She finds report cards, white-bordered photographs, old diaries, an unstamped letter. Armstrong descended to the attic, a specific mission with the hope for something illuminating, recovered, found. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Had he practiced this line, looking into his bathroom mirror, shaving cream on his neck, prepping for an important job interview? If he hadn't returned, that's how Jan would have remembered him. A young man at Purdue, confidence offset by earnest sincerity, the smell of shaving cream and a sharpened pencil behind his ear. Armstrong said, "It's very pretty out here." And Cronkite said, "Very pretty. That's the first compliment the moon's had." The question wasn't would the world be different, but how. After the ceremony of unfolding the letter, Sarah looks at her loose cursive without reading. She isn't old, but old enough that the paper is brittle. Even with a deep inhale, she cannot detect perfume. In the letter, she told him she looks at the moon and wonders where he is. Her innocence is embarrassing. She was a young woman in love, as good a thing to be as any. She remembers watching the landing and thinking, wherever he was, he must be watching as well, so they couldn't be far apart. The envelope contained a picture. Her friends told her that was the thing to do. In the picture, his arm is around her shoulder. They went to Evanston Beach that day. She wore a modest one-piece under her clothes, sneaking her bikini into her purse. Had she been that young? At the time, she marveled at her sophistication, on a day trip with her older boyfriend. Written on the back, "Yours." He was the sole owner of firsts. First time she looked in the mirror with the word beauty in mind, pursing her lips and widening her eyes, giggling at something unsaid. First time he placed his hand on the small of her back and she lost control of her feet. First song, first kiss, first in over her head, first fight. He enlisted, his older brother was there, she couldn't understand. First tears, first makeup, first relief, learning they could fight without the world ending. In his car, first and last goodbye. They drove around past midnight with the top down. He crooned "Build Me Up Buttercup" to make her laugh. When he got back, she would be done with high school and they would get a small apartment in the city. Her parents warned her, as if they could prevent their daughter's heartbreak any more than they could its instrument. She never journeyed to trace his name, her face reflected in black granite. By the time the memorial was erected, she had a husband, a baby on the way. Like those before, after, and in simultaneity, she told the moon. Armstrong and every move he made were moon firsts. First step here, first step there, an itch the moon didn't recognize until it was scratched. Houston radioed Armstrong to retrieve contingency samples, but he was confident nothing could go wrong. He told them moon dust, collecting on his boots like silt, was fine-grained, almost powder. His boots sunk in, but a skin's layer beneath, the moon's surface was packed clay. He disappeared off camera, still responding to radio calls, taking in the moon alone, leaving the world with a view between Apollo's legs. Armstrong did not tell the moon about the turtle babies hatching in her light, how she kept people safe and got them into trouble, how people weaved their fortunes gazing at her face, how wolves howl and people howl and what it means to howl, a sound reserved for her, how she's a god and a cookie and a cheese, how George Bailey promised her to his wife back when she was only his buffalo gal, how children stare at her late at night while they are taking first stabs at personhood and want to get it right, how humans, at their best, want to get it right, and that's the main occasion for this visit. Sarah hears Rebecca stomping through the kitchen, the screen door clattering shut. Sarah calls, "In the attic, coming down." Waiting at the bottom, Rebecca remarks she forgot the attic exists. "Grandma came by with stuff," Sarah says. A worried look flashes on Rebecca's face. "If you didn't plan dinner, can I sleep at Ashley's?" Sarah wonders how long it will be until Rebecca lies about where she is going. If Sarah could be honest, what would she say? "Wait till your father's home," she says. When Armstrong visited, there was an exchange. He took her rocks, scraped her surface, left a flag. An emissary for the world, he left. A disc containing messages from 74 world leaders. A gold olive branch. An Apollo 1 patch, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. "We made it." A message of peace and vulnerability to the moon and future visitors. He thought what we all thought, that we could hold onto her and capture something elusive, that we could claim her, keep her, ridiculous and sweet.
That was Megan Rowe, reading her short story, Tranquility Base, published in the July 21st issue of the Spokesman Review as part of their Summer Stories short fiction series. After her story, Megan and I talked about the moon landing and her idea for this story. So this year's Summer Stories prompt was the summer of 1969. Mm-hmm. So obviously you chose a big sort of national event to center around, which was the moon landing that summer.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me how you went from that idea to this particular story.
Well, originally I wanted to write about the moon landing because I was intimidated by summer of 69 because I was not alive when it happened, but I figured that the moon landing, I could access the video of it and I would have the same information that everyone on land had when it was happening. And then when I was writing about it, I realized that even though I had that same information, that I couldn't possibly understand what it was like to see that at that time. Which is how history works, right? None of these events happened in isolation. Mm. And so I really felt that it was necessary when I decided that I wanted to have this other storyline that was going back and forth, that I really kind of looked at the Vietnam War too.
Mm.
And that's how I got the character of Sarah and realized what was happening with her. And this box that her mother left her. And so that's kind of how that worked out for me.
So those flashes of the moon landing, are those coming from Sarah's perspective as well? Are those her memories, or is that a different point of view?
For me, it was a different point of view. It was obviously sort of this distant roving third, because we kind of get Jan's perspective mm-hmm. too, but from a great distance. About how she views her husband. I found that quote from Life magazine, and I found it really interesting that the way our loved ones could possibly even have a significant place in history, as Armstrong undeniably did, but to us, that's just my loved one.
Mm-hmm.
That's my husband. Mm. That's my husband who's potentially leaving his children, leaving me. And, you know, she was watching this, having known that all of his colleagues and very close friends, and she was very close with the wives as well, died in Apollo 1.
Megan Rowe's story is Tranquility Base in this year's Summer Stories for the Spokesman Review. Megan, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for talking with me, Chris.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Join us tomorrow for more summer stories from local authors Sharma Shields and Sherry Jones. And if you miss one of these great stories, you can find the full text at spokesman.com, or you can listen to The Bookshelf podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or the NPR One app. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini.